response and said, are you okay? I said, yeah, I think I need to cry. She's like, well, go over there in the corner and cry. But hurry up. Come back. I've shared my story many, many times. But I haven't shared my story with my family here. And that's what I'm going to do right now. I've been in the program 10 years, and from age 12 to age 32 is very dysfunctional and a cycle of dysfunction and abuse. Growing up, that's what I saw, drugs and alcohol, and it was the thing to do. So when I got of age, it was, I'm going to drink. I'm going to get me something to drink, smoke me some weed. From what I saw, it was an everyday thing. You know, like I said, it was a cycle of dysfunction, abuse, you know, me growing up. And you didn't tell what went on in mama's house. So you tell somebody what go on in here, you in trouble. So you don't tell nothing. So going to school, I didn't have friends. I was afraid that if I told what went on in mama's house, I was going to get a whooping. So just being off to the side is what I remember about going to school. Growing up, it was eight of us girls. My mom had four, and my aunt had, my mom had three, and my aunt had four. And mama looking at me like, wait a minute, what? And my other aunt had one. And so eight of us girls growing up, and I wasn't a big kid. I was a big kid sometimes, and I was a little kid sometimes. So I got to hang out with the big kids, and they put makeup on me and stuff and go hang out with the boys and sneak out. And then I had to play with the little kids sometimes. So talk about confused. Like, what is really going on? And there came me trying to fit in. So the self-identity thing didn't happen. And in recovery, and I know all of this because I'm in recovery today. I couldn't put words to nothing. So I could put words to stuff today. But me trying to find out who I was non-existent. I didn't even understand or know any of that. And so, he gave me a tissue. Where I come from in my meetings, my home group, New Hope group, if you give somebody a tissue, that means you're telling them to stop crying, that your tears don't matter. It's okay, Carlos. There's going to be some more, so thank you. But growing up, I always felt just on the outside looking in. I always felt alone. I always felt, and I always wanted to be around them, but I didn't know, you know, what to do or how to be. I didn't know how to be one of the big kids, and I was tired of the little kids because they always cried and stuff. Schoolwork, it just didn't click with me. So going to school, For a couple of years, I got it, but something didn't click. So I always sat in the back of the schoolroom, and when it was time for me to answer questions, I didn't have an answer. So that kind of added on to me just being in the background and falling in the background. So the summer going to seventh grade, we moved to the neighborhood. We moved to the hill, and going to junior high, and that's when the 12 years old and the lady next door let me babysit for her. She'd drink a green bottle, the White Mountain Cooler. Asked her if I could have some. She said, don't tell your mama because your mama crazy. And she let me drink some, and I liked it. And I was fuzzy, and I didn't care, and I don't remember watching her kids. And I went home, and I threw up. And when my mom came home, I thought for sure I was going to get a whooping, and she just looked at me and she said, a drunk ain't shit. And okay, I could do this again, but I can't let her know what I'm doing. So they started the open gym basketball up at King. We lived across the street from Martin Luther King School. And the police would come up there and play basketball with the kids. And so, yeah, I remember the paper food stamps. You buy something for 90 cents and you get, buy something for 10 cents and you get 90 cents back. So I save up my $1 paper food stamps at the people hanging outside the store. Now, I had to find the right person because everybody knew my mom and my uncles, and they weren't going to go in there and buy me a 40 ounce. Had to find the right one because they, oh, no, you run them browns. I ain't buying you nothing. And so I share my food stamps with them, and they buy me a 40 ounce. So I'm supposed to be playing basketball at King in the gym, but I was behind the gym drinking my 40 ounces. And I knew how to hide it from mom because I pretend like I was doing my homework and go in my room. And if she saw me acting like I was doing my homework, then she'd leave me alone. So I knew how to lie and manipulate her. My grandma tried. I used to drink her liquor and fill it up with water. So the alcohol came first. I've been an alcoholic since I was 12. I've been a blackout drinker all of that time. And when I say blackout, I wasn't laying down somewhere and coming to. That happened a lot. I would be drinking and come to standing here talking to y'all. I don't know what happened in between that time. So I wasn't always passed out. I was making friends and playing cards and come to playing dominoes over somebody's house at the projects. I don't know. So I'm like, hey, how you doing? Do I know you? Yeah, we hung out yesterday. So a lot of that stuff that I did in that time, y'all can imagine, a young naive girl in the streets thinking she know everything. I got taken advantage of a whole lot when I thought I was doing something. I got taken advantage of a whole lot, a whole lot of broken promises, a whole lot of nothing, and I thought I was doing something. I met a guy, so it was a whole lot of nothing, and like I said, broken promises, and I compromised myself and stuff that I didn't want to do. I said no a lot, and it didn't matter. So therefore, I figured that I didn't matter. I hope I'm not talking around too much, but in the mixed room with men and women, I don't share it. I don't go into deep detail with my story about what happened to me as a young woman. But I did say no a lot, and it didn't matter. So that added on to me feeling lost, and then the alcohol was my friend. And I didn't have any morals to compromise, but what I did believe in and what I thought I felt about myself just went out the door. So I met a guy. The guys came around. My mom said they only wanted one thing from me, but she didn't tell me what that one thing was. I just want to go out to eat. Can we go eat? She's like, you ain't going nowhere. But again, I learned how to manipulate, and I learned how to lie and learn how to sneak around without her knowing what I was doing. And she tried, and my grandma tried. But at an early age, I learned how to get around and manipulate and lie. And this one dude came around and said he liked me and that I was pretty. What you mean I'm pretty? He's so pretty. Boy, he said that he loved me. Boy, was holding my hand and stuff. And he turned out to be a predator. And I fell in love with him because he said he loved me and I was pretty. And one thing that I share when I share my story, because I also work with a organization who works with victims of domestic minor sex trafficking, is that our young girls, even our young boys in our lives, tell them that they're pretty and that you love them, because if you don't, somebody else is going to, and that person is not going to be a very nice person, because those people eat, drink, and sleep thinking of ways to trick our young kids into doing what they want them to do. And so he said he wanted me to have sex with older men for money, and I didn't want to let him down. So I'm probably about 17, 16 now. And that went on, and that started this cycle of, I've done this. What is my family going to say? I got a big sister and a little sister, and my mom, she did her thing. She drank, and and she crazy, so she cussed us out a lot. And my big sister and my little sister, our relationship wasn't that good because they said when I drank, I act like mama. And I took my little sister diamond earrings and lost one. And I used to beat her up, and then I beat her up one day, and she went and got mama crowbar, and I never beat her up no more, so I couldn't beat her up no more. And then my big sister didn't want to hang out with me no more. So just the isolated feeling. So, okay, why not turn to this? And I did that. And that led into a whole nother cycle of suicide attempts and me bringing girls into this kind of lifestyle. And when it was time to leave, I felt like I couldn't go home because I didn't know what my family was going to say about me. I didn't know what they was going to do or how they was going to act towards me. And so I felt like I couldn't go home. So the only way to get out of that lifestyle was to die, was to kill myself. So the suicide attempt started. And the worst feeling in the world back then was trying to kill yourself, and then you take a whole bunch of pills, and then you wake up and say, damn, I can't even do this right. And it was multiple times. It was multiple times because, again, I didn't matter. And the manipulation and the emotional and mental abuse, that was a constant. And I started to believe the lies that were being told to me. So I left him, and I went back, and I left him again. I went back, and I left him again, and I went back, and I left him again, and I went back. And that's what I did because I didn't know how to have conversations with men without something being exchanged. I didn't know how to handle money because I just didn't because it was never mine. Just like life skills, I didn't have them because everything was done for me. My only job was to go out and get the money, and that's what I did. Everything else was taken care of. So when I left, I was just stuck. I didn't know what to do, you know. And so the last time I left, I was like, I can do this. I can do this. So I went and got a CNA license, certified nursing assistant, and I did that for a while, and I loved it. But what was written across my forehead was alcoholic and drunk and the life that I had. And so I wasn't good enough to have a regular job. I wasn't good enough to be around regular people. And I did lose that job because of my drinking. Because when I drink, I like the gin, and the gin comes out of my pores. And so I went to work, and I'm doing my job, and she said, you smell like alcohol. It's like, oh, this is from last night. But I lost that job because of alcohol. The lifestyle that I had was because of alcohol, because of the choices that I made. And then I tried anything and everything. So I moved to Arizona, and I had a couple of regular jobs, but the alcohol has been a constant. Then it was the weed, and then, you know, and the men, and I always had to have a boyfriend or six of them. I didn't work how regular people did, because if I get the job, I'm going straight to the boss, and me and the boss gonna have something going on. So when I call out, I ain't gonna get in trouble. I'm still gonna have my job. Again, it was the manipulation that I learned early on in life. And so I did that for a while, and my best friend got pregnant. And again, I didn't know how to put words to what was going on, but she got pregnant. It was the happiest time in her life. But I always wanted something to love me. I always wanted something that I could love that was mine, and I wanted a baby, and she didn't want one. Well, she got pregnant, and who she thinks she is, does she get everything? And again, I didn't know how to put words to it, but I was so jealous and I was so envious that I was hanging out with somebody, and she said, I'm gonna smoke some crack. I said, give me some of that. Because I was so hurt that, oh my God. And in recovery, my sponsor made me put words to it. She's like, oh, you were jealous. I'm like, no, nobody that word. I'm not jealous of nothing or nobody. But I had to. I had to admit that I was so jealous and envious that I just gave up. And crack sounded like a good thing to do. And that was still in Arizona. I was supposed to be there to try to help her with the kids, and I was so mean to her while she was pregnant. And again, I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what I was going through and why I was acting like this to my best friend. And I was really mean to her when she had the babies. I said I would come help, and I'll show up here and there with an attitude. And but now I got a crack addiction. But I'm good because, you know, I'm not like the people that I saw growing up. You know what I'm saying? So I moved back to Omaha. And if y'all can believe it, the same drug dealers was selling dope at the same houses as when I was growing up on the same corners. But here I am. I don't know I got an addiction because I just smoke some crack sometimes, every once in a while. But once I get my alcohol level got to a certain point, I had to smoke. Not sure how that went, but something in my body always clicked, and I had to have dope. And, you know, when I moved back home, my family wasn't mad at me. They didn't judge me for the lifestyle that I had, and they was cool with me. So my thing is that you get with the drug dealer, right, so you can get all the dope that you want. That's how it went, but I guess it didn't because people talked about me, but I didn't care. I was high. My family loved me to the point where they let me get high in their houses. They loved me to the point where they rolled up at the dope house and said, "Come here, girl, what you doing? You know what I'm doing. I just come to check on you." You know, they loved me to the point where it was like, "Do you need anything?" And here I am, a junkie, and they still loved me. So I was wrong all those years when I wanted to come home. And I didn't know the depths that it would take me to. A really, really good friend of mine didn't know I was getting high. She probably heard. And I went over her house and I said, "I don't got no pipe, but I wanna smoke." And the look that she gave me, I can still feel that look today. I put the dope on her dresser and the look that she gave me, I still feel it today. And me and her got high together, and I talked stuff to her when I got high and everything. And it was to the point where I lost my car, I lost my place to live, clothes, wearing the same clothes. I was a junkie. I was a junkie to the point where I just didn't care. And I'm sleeping at the dope house. I went in the dope house, it was spring. I came out, it was snow on the ground. I don't even know what year it is. Holidays was non-existent. Birthdays, I don't even know how old I am. Had to call my sister and say, "How old are you?" So you could tell me how old I am. So time went by and I didn't even know. That same friend that I'm talking about, I was talking stuff to her and cussing her out, because that's what I did, to cuss people out and talk stuff to them. And I told her how I was tired of, you know, getting high and how, you know, I need to do better for myself. And it still goes through my head today. I'm going to say some cuss words right now, y'all. And she said, "Fuck you, Keisha. Get off of your ass and do something about it." And like I said, when things get hard today, I still go back to the words that lady said to me. You know, she's my biggest fan today. She's my biggest fan today. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do or how to do it. And so I lived in Arizona before. And like I said, you know, me and the boss man, we're doing our thing. So I got on a plane and I went to Arizona. And my best thinking got me in a relationship with a guy. And I ended up in a domestic violence shelter. All I had was my clothes and my Bible and the cell phone that he was paying. So I still had to be nice to him, right? Cause you know, he paying for the bill. And I could have went to, you know, a couple of people's houses, but I knew when I woke up that next day in the shelter, that everything had to change, that something had to change, that everything that I did in my life and everywhere I've been and everything that I ever had was in two suitcases and a plastic bag. And I sat on the edge of the bed at the shelter and I didn't know what to do. I was scared to get out of my bed because I didn't have a joint. So the last day I smoked crack was October 28th, 2018. But I was still drinking and I was smoking weed, but I didn't know how to get out of that bunk. So I would just go to the cafeteria and come back and eat and sleep. And I knew that something had to change. I didn't go outside of the building. And one day this lady came in and was like, you look like you need some help. And she gave me this card and she was supposed to be in our room. She said she was going to the cafeteria and she never came back. So she said, "I need some outpatient." And I called that place. And that place said they couldn't help me, and they gave me another number, and they gave me another number. And I'm like, you know, and I just kept calling. I don't know why. I just knew, I guess I didn't have nothing to do or I really wanted help, but I just kept calling, and I kept calling this place and that place and that place. And right before I gave up, the last place I called said, oh, we'll come pick you up tomorrow, and we'll do an assessment. And oh, y'all gonna pick me up and we gonna do it? So that was the first time looking back in my recovery journey that I had to do the footwork. That was the first time that not giving up on something that was for me worked out. So my higher power that I choose to call God, my higher power just kept putting people and places in my path. Like I said, that lady never came back in the room. I don't know where she came from and I don't know where she went. Never knew what her name was. And so I started outpatient, and the first day of outpatient, there was an AA meeting, and they suggested that we go down there. Like I said, I'm scared. I'm scared of the world. It's a lot of fear. I don't know what to do. And I went to that AA meeting, and the lady said, it was me and another woman, and she said, do you have a sponsor? It's like, what's a sponsor? She's like, well, somebody you call every day and help you with the steps and take you through stuff. And I'm like, well, you going to be my sponsor? And so it had a joke for a long time that she was my temporary sponsor because she didn't think I was going to call her. And I called her. Again, I didn't know how to live life, period. And here I am at a shelter and wanting to make a change in my life. And I knew that everything had to change. So it was time for me to leave. And I got picked to go to the other side of the shelter, the recovery part. And we did groups and meetings, and we did a meditation one night, and it was a guided meditation, and the lady had an English accent and the lights were off, and we're doing this meditation, and it hasn't happened ever before and it hasn't happened since, but I'm walking down this, it's like the basement of a castle, and the stairs are going down, and I turn and I see this little girl in the corner. It's a little toddler in the corner, and it's me, and I'm like, whoa, what's going on? So I pick her up and I got her right here, and I keep going. The little girl got my face. And so I figured it was me. And I keep going down this corridor, and then there's stairs, and the water is rising, and there's somebody here just trying to keep theyself down, dunk theyself in the water and make sure that they stay down, and I lift her up, and that's me too as a teenager. So I got myself as a toddler in this hand, I got myself as a teenager holding on, and it's like during it, you know, we just had to keep going, and for some reason this is what's going on, and I can't stop it. And that right there told me that I had to pick my own self up. I had to do the footwork, and I had to keep on this path and see what was going to happen. And it was the scariest thing ever because I had to take responsibility for my life. I didn't have him or her or she and he or them doing it. Like, it told me that I had to do it myself, and I never had to do that. It was always somebody else. It was always somebody else, but this was telling me that I had to take responsibility for my life. And it was scary, and I had to write about it and journal about it. And it was time for me to leave the shelter, and me and my case manager had started calling places, and met my case manager from outpatient. And because I didn't have a job, I couldn't get into this program, and because I didn't have transportation, I couldn't get into that program, and it was just, I couldn't get in here, I couldn't get in here. And the Dignity program was on the list, and we called probably about 2 hours worth of places. And the Dignity program is the only program that called back out of all these programs. And so I asked for prayer at church that I have a safe, clean place that'll support me in my recovery to go live at, because it was time for me to leave the shelter. And the only place that called back was that program. And it was a year-long program, and they was going to take my cell phone, and it wasn't no intimate relationships for a whole year. They was trying to kill me. I mean, all I did was have relationships and talk on the cell phone. I mean, they were going to kill me. What is going on? But I had people in my life that said, hey, this is what it is. This is real life. This is a recovery program, and this is the only place that called back. Year-long program. I had to go live with those ladies for a whole year. I just had flashback. I'm traumatized. So it's the Dignity Program, and I went, and you know, my sponsor, she just took me by the hand. She had me doing service work at conventions and roundups and being greeters and signing people up and doing fundraisers. And it was, I didn't know it was service work. I just thought I was just doing stuff because she asked me to do it. So she was keeping me busy because she knew what I needed. So talking about service work, I was like, no, I've never did service work. And she was like, yeah, you have. Let me tell you what you've been doing. Like, this is, you've been doing service work. I remember we went to this Ladybugs meeting, and I had to stand at the door and hug people on the way in and be a greeter. Like, oh, hugging these ladies. Ladybugs meeting, it sounded like they had red, black hats on or something. But it was just a women's meeting. And after a while, she didn't have to tell me to get up and go greet people at the door no more. It's just what I did. We were riding in the car one day, and you know, I was just so serious. I was like, I got to get this program. This is serious. This is life and death to me. This is my recovery. And she laughed at me with one of those wicked kind of laughs. And I was like, cuss words was going through my head. And she was like, you have to stop taking yourself so seriously. She's like, if you're too serious, you're not going to get this program. She taught me how to laugh again. She taught me how to laugh at myself. She taught me how to look at myself. And we did my fourth step. And I say that I stand here today being able to share my story with you guys because I did a thorough fourth step. So I wrote down stuff, but it was stuff that I didn't write on the paper. And I'm like, I'm not telling her I'm going to the grave with this. So she's evil during the fourth step. And she kept saying, is that it? So I'm crying now, and is that it? I got to the point where I'm upside down on her sofa with my head on the seat part, my legs up in the air, just crying and telling her everything that I was gonna take to my grave with me, everything that happened to me when I was a kid, everything that I did, everything that was done to me. And it kept coming out, and she kept saying, is that it? And you know, it's not that bad. And every time she said, is that it, something else came up that I was going to take to my grave. Is that it? And something else came up. If I would have kept, because all those things that I said I was going to take to the grave with me is what kept me high, is what kept me feeling different. Because I said I was unique, and she said, no, you're not. I'm different. She said, no, you're not different. So all the things that she kept saying, is that it? And they kept coming out, or all the things that I was, the guilt and the shame of stuff that I did or was done to me. And don't you know who I am? Or I get some tears on for the dope man. And you know, we lied too, made up stories. But it was still that guilt and that shame that was still down there as to why I thought it was okay to make up those stories. We sorted out what was lies. I told so many lies. We sorted out what was lies and what was truth. But I stand here today because I did a thorough fourth step, and I was able to find somebody that I trusted enough to tell everything to. And she fed me pizza. So that's all I needed was pizza. Pepperoni, thank you very much. So I went to that program. I had to make my bed every day. I forgot to make my bed one day, and I had to clean out the big trash can you take to the curb, and I make my bed every day today. So I still make my bed every day today. I had to cook. I used to cook the pizza thing on the back of the Bisquick box, and sometimes it was good and it would be gone, and sometimes the pan still be full and put it in the refrigerator. But I got that recipe right sometimes. It was like, you gonna make this again? Yep. I perfected the Bisquick pizza recipe on the side. I went back to school. I had to get a job, so I worked and I went to school. We had a class every day, some kind of group or a class every day. We had mandatory fun night. Well, I got to go to school and I got to work, so I don't want to do mandatory fun night. I'm not doing it. I don't know what you're talking about. I had more fun than everybody because they didn't make me do it. It's mandatory. But I had more fun than everybody. So just not taking myself so seriously and doing what was suggested. When I really knew that I wasn't done working because I worked some steps and I'm feeling better, what really got me was when they gave me a piece of paper and asked me what my favorite color was and what my favorite show was and the stuff that I like. Well, I slid the paper across the desk and got an attitude, and I got an attitude because I didn't know that stuff. I didn't know what I liked. I didn't know what my favorite color was. But see, I thought I did some steps and I set some goals, and you know, and that stuff was coming up, and you know, and it's a never ending process. Like, my favorite color ain't the same as it was 10 years ago. So I graduated that program and got a foundation. My sponsor said I was her temporary sponsee. She started introducing me to all these women. I said, are you trying to pawn me off on these ladies? She said, no, I'm trying to help you build a foundation of women that can support you no matter what you go through. And I was like, I don't need them. I just need you. But we got together every week, and I still have those women's phone numbers in my phone, and I still can call them, and they still love on me no matter what. Yeah, and so she helped me build that foundation in recovery of women who call me on my stuff, and we cry together and we laugh together and we don't wash our hair together. That's a song we made up. And after I graduated that program, I went back every weekend and slept on the couch because that was my safe place. I didn't trust myself. In some situations, I still don't trust myself today. I wouldn't trust myself sitting on the same couch as you watching a movie in the dark. You. So I don't put myself in certain situations today because I still don't trust myself with some stuff. Okay, let's get back. But I went and I spent the night every night, and I started sharing my story. I got on the board of that organization I was telling y'all about, with the sex trafficking victims, and we were in a board meeting one night, and you know, I'm silly as all get out right now because I did learn how to laugh again and not take myself so seriously. And I said, well, Google me, and I had just shared at an Arizona State University human trafficking event. And when we Googled my name, it said, Kakeisha Brown, survivor of domestic minor sex trafficking. And I started crying. And right then is when I had to make the decision, either I'm going to continue sharing my story, or I'm not going to say nothing else about it and do some more stuff so Google could pick that up, and it'll be up there then. And I made that decision right then and there, after I cried a little bit and talked some stuff, that I was going to continue to share my story, and I was going to continue to stay in recovery and help other women out of that life that I thought that I had to kill myself to get out of. So I moved to Tennessee to help open up a safe house for girls 18 to 24 for domestic minor survivors of domestic minor sex trafficking. And so today I still work with that organization. I also am a certified peer recovery specialist in the state of Tennessee.
A
certified peer recovery specialist in the state of Tennessee. And I'm a recovery minister. I work for a church. And I work with young ladies who are new in recovery, and I give it to them raw because I have to. I'm really nice on the inside. I got a good heart, but I be talking stuff to them and cussing and stuff. But I needed somebody like that in my life who was going to call me on my crap, and I know that that's what they need. So when I started as the administrator of the program, it's a women's sober living house, transitional living house. When I started, everything had to be the way it was for me when I was in the program, because this works, I know it works, so it got to go like this, and if it don't, then you wrong, and that's what it is. And I broke. I broke to the point where my ego took over. and I knew everything. And it got to the point where I wasn't getting along with anybody. I wasn't asking questions on how to do nothing because I know what to do and how to do it. And that was 2 years ago. And I forgot what I was doing. And one of the girls said, you don't think that, because I was talking about her attitude. And she said, you don't think that your attitude affects us? Like, you say that our attitude affects you? I'm like, I said something smart to her and send it to her room. But it hit me to the point where, oh, my goodness, my bad attitude is affecting them. I'm talking about, I knew everything. My ego was so big to the, it was like, yeah. So I broke. So one of my sponsees asked me about character defects. So it's a list of 192. I probably got 180 something of the character defects on that paper. And she said, well, how did you deal with yours? I said, well, how my higher power works with me is that he hits me in the head. So you don't want to do how I do. I get knocked in the head and knocked down to the point where I'm in the middle of the sanctuary in the dark crying. That's how my character defects show up and hit me. He hit me with mine real hard. But I can't give up when stuff like that happens. I have to depend on the people in my life, the women in my life and the men in my life. Everybody who came up here and read is part of my, the readings is part of my system, is part of my my network. That's right, TV. And so I have to use them. Because I have been broken in recovery, but that didn't mean I had to give up. And I haven't given up, but I know that I'm not exempt. I know that I'm not exempt from picking up one bad attitude. I told my sponsors, my sponsor in Arizona said I had to get a sponsor when I moved to Tennessee, but she'll be my sponsor for life. So I told my sponsors, both of them, that I was going to get into a relationship. And I told them I didn't ask for suggestions. I did. One of them said, play the tape through and what you going to do. I'm like, no, I love him and he loves me and we're going to do this. And I did it. And nobody could have told me nothing different. I was so stressed and the relationship wasn't for me. It got to the point where I got home one day and I seen two crack rocks and a crack pipe on my end table. And that's my brain. No, it wasn't no dope in my house. It wasn't no pipe in my house. That was me. That was the addict that lives on the inside of me saying, ha, we got you. We still here. I was driving down the street and was like, we should go to the bar right there. And I'm like, wait a minute. I got 10 fucking years. I mean, I got 10 years. How is this happening to me? I have to remember that I have an addict that lives on the inside of me who is hungry. But as long as I keep feeding the spiritual part, as long as I keep feeding the good side, It things will get better, but I can't forget. I can't forget where I come from, and I can't forget that her name is Sharika, and she's not a very nice person. And so Sharika still lives on the inside of me and is waiting for me to get so stressed out that I don't know what to do, feeling guilt and shame because I didn't listen to suggestions. Because I still feel, we still get guilt and shame, but we have to work through them, you know. So she waiting for any little thing for so that she can creep out. But it really tripped me out when I saw the dope and the pipe on my table. And I told the dude, I was like, you gotta go. He said, I don't understand. I said, I know you don't. That's the problem. I take you to the Greyhound right now. Thank you very much. I'll even pack for you. But I have to remember where I come from. I have to remember being desperate, being lost, being scared of life, being scared of people, being scared to live. I have to remember not taking showers and what I smelled like and what I did. I can't forget none of that because I've early in recovery, I had a dream that I was walking down the street. All I saw was these nice little blue shoes. I looked down, it was nice blue sequins dress and a purse strapped around. And I was strutting doo-doo. And I got to the mirror and I had a matted wig on and the makeup, and it's me. And the makeup was running and down. That's me. That's me. I'm one arm length away. And I can't forget where I come from and I can't forget where I took my addiction to. And I have to talk to my sponsor. I have to talk to women. I have to be honest. I gotta cry sometimes. And if I got an attitude, then I just work through the attitude. You my friend, you still love me. I cussed you out yesterday, but we good today. I just gotta be real. I have to be real and feel the feelings and walk through the feelings because I'm not exempt. And thank you for letting me share. Now I can keep talking if you want me to.